Episode 59, Podcasting in the Law, my conversation with entertainment law and podcaster Gordon Faremark. Gordon is an attorney and podcaster who helps artists, writers, producers, and directors achieve their dreams in the field of theater, film, television, and new media. Since his admission to practice in 1992, Gordon has focused his attention on providing sound, practical, legal, and strategic advice to his clients so they can make smart deals, grow their businesses, and do great things. Gordon is the producer and host of the Entertainment Law Update, a podcast for artists and professionals in the entertainment industries. He is also the author of the podcast, blog, and new media producer's legal survival guide. Enjoy. Hey everyone, just a quick shout out before we start. Are you enjoying the TechSavvyLawyer.page podcast? Consider giving us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast feeds. Also, consider buying us a cup of coffee or two from the link on our blog to help defray some of the production costs. Thanks, and again, enjoy. Gordon, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Michael, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you being here. And to get things started, tell us, what is your current tech setup?
My tech setup is based around a Mac. I've been a Mac user for a while now. I always said when I've been in practice for 30 something years, and I started out, of course, on PCs. And at one point, my wife, who was a Mac user shortly after we met, was really encouraging me to get a Mac. I'll never switch. Well, I switched.
What was your first?
A MacBook Pro, maybe 2012, okay. Somewhere around there.
Okay.
And actually, no, it was probably a little earlier than that. But anyway, 2009, maybe, when I started my podcast, actually. I was already on a Mac. And so it's built around the Mac and mics. I'm currently using a Shure MV7 microphone, which is a USB and XLR, so I can plug it into my mixer and whatever. That mixer is a Rodecaster Pro. That allows me to record my show. The show that I do, Entertainment Law Update, we do live to drive. So we start the show, we start press record, press the music. When it finishes, we start talking, we finish the show, press music, and then out we go, stop the recording, upload the file. Cool. Very little, if any, post-production is done. And that's part of just having a streamlined, fast workflow so we can get the episodes out and not eat up lawyer time doing it.
I got to ask, so I'm running off of a Blue Yeti. Now, if I may ask, why would I want to, and I say this not accusatory, but as just, I want to know the details of why would I want to move from, say, a Blue Yeti to your mic?
You're asking the right guy, I'll tell you.
Perfect.
I was a sound guy before I went to law school.
Oh, okay. So excellent.
There are two different sort of classes of microphones, and it really is the technology that goes into them. There are condenser microphones. Mm-hmm. Use electricity to magnetize the coil that picks up the sound and then converts it into a different electrical signal. That tends to be a more sensitive, more delicate kind of a sound, and it tends to pick up a lot of room noise and background noise. And so the Blue Yeti is a condenser microphone.
Okay.
The mic I'm using and the mics that I generally recommend for podcasting are dynamic microphones, which don't require power in order to operate. They rely on the sound waves to fluctuate against a regular magnet, and that generates the electrical current that becomes the sound that's recorded. It takes more amplification on the front end of that to get a really nice, robust sound. But the advantage is if you're not in a perfectly tuned, soundproof room, you're not going to pick up a lot of the little thing. Like right now, there's a fan going across the room from me, and there's noise out in the rest of the house where I'm working, and we're not going to hear most of that unless it gets really crazy loud. On something like what you're using, you might be more prone to those kinds of things. So if you're a podcaster, if you're going to be recording in your office at where there's hubbub around, unless you want to hear that hubbub, a dynamic mic is probably a better choice. Now, the Blue Yeti is a great microphone, don't get me wrong, but it does require some attention to what's going on around as well.
Now, a moment ago, you mentioned that you had a Rodecaster processor?
A Rodecaster Pro is a multi-channel mixer and recording console.
Okay.
And it's put out by Rode, which is the maker of a lot of good quality microphones and other sound equipment. What it allows me to do is when I record my show, which uses a Skype call for my co-host, and we may bring in guests and things like that, is to have independent control of everybody's audio channel.
Okay.
Plus, we can press sound pads and have cue the music, and it records on board inside the mixing console as well. So it's all sort of a I won't call it an all-in-one device, but it's a very versatile recording device. Before I had that, which it's only been a few years, I had separate mixers and sound cards and recording decks, and it was a ton of equipment in a rack sitting on my desk. And I was able to get rid of all that in favor of this one device. It's a great tool if you're really serious about podcasting. I'll say nowadays, when you have guests and things like that, there are a lot of great tools out there that use, well, like we're recording on a Zoom call right now. Right. Zoom doesn't always have the best sound quality. It's pretty good. There are others like it that are specifically designed for higher sound quality recordings. And it's possible to do a show with guests nowadays without any special outboard equipment.
You're a former professional sound guy. Does the average attorney who wants to do his or her own podcast, do they need something as in-depth as a Rodecaster and a Shure mic? Or is it safe to say you could go with a Blue Yeti and be fine for the rest of your podcasting career?
I think a lot of people do. This microphone is not a particularly expensive microphone. It's probably maybe double what the Yeti costs. Yeti costs about $115 or something like that.
I think it's like $100 now. But
yeah, this is about a $250 microphone. So it's not a tremendous investment, especially for lawyers who have a little cash to invest. And I just think this is a great sounding microphone. That's why I chose it. I've played with lots of different mics because I'm a geek about that kind of stuff. And yeah, I'm not a huge fan of the Yeti, as you can probably tell.
No worries. And to each their own, and we're not here to judge anyone. But how much extra does the Rodecaster enhance your overall podcasting,
though? What it does is it streamlines the workflow. Because I'm able to, everything is built in. The recording happens on board there. It's not relying on the computer's processors to do the recording.
Okay.
It allows me to play the music in real time and mix the volume levels and things like that. Again, if I wasn't a sound guy, probably wouldn't have bothered to get into that kind of thing.
So I'm assuming the mic is more important than the mixer.
Look, the microphone is the first place that you're capturing sound and doing anything with it. And like any technology, really, if you put garbage in, you get garbage out. If you put high quality in, you're better able to get high quality out. And so I think investing in a good, you don't have to spend tons of money, a good, decent microphone that will do the job and reject that background noise is a wise investment.
And I see that you like the Shure MV7, and I'll make sure that's in the show notes for everyone to take a look at. Of course, I'll also have a link to the Blue Yeti. And trust me, I'm looking at possibly upgrading. Yeah. And I'm going to take what you said to heart.
There's another mic I should tell you about. Since somebody's just an entry-level microphone for podcasting. They're two microphones that fit this bill. One is called the Audio-Technica ATR2100. It also plugs into USB or XLR, so you can grow with it and plug it into a mixer later.
Okay.
Nice quality sound, but I think it's about $80, maybe $75. Sometimes you find them on sale. And it has a sort of a sibling made by a company called Samson, S-A-M-S-O-N. Q2U is the model. And it also, same thing, it's a dual USB or XLR, tends to be a little louder of a microphone. So some people really like that. And they both, it's a kit. You buy the whole thing for under $100 and plug it in and you're good to go.
So all three of the mics we've talked about, and I'm referring to the ones you've talked about, the Shure, the Samson, and the Audio-Technica, if I heard that correctly?
Yeah.
They're all USB, but can be transferred over to a mixer.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're all dynamic mics, so they're going to do that background noise rejection a little better.
Awesome. I learned something new today, and I appreciate that. So tell us, what is your current computer?
So I'm using a 2021 Mac Mini with the M1 chip. It's not a super machine by any stretch of the imagination. I think I upgraded the memory to the 16 gigabytes of memory. But other than that, it's your basic Mac Mini for about $1,000 when I bought it. And it's my office computer as well as my recording computer.
And how many screens do you have, or what screens do you have?
So I have two monitors. Technically, I have three because I'm actually talking to you using a teleprompter, which has a third monitor that is a clone of the second monitor on the system.
Gotcha.
That way I'm looking directly into the camera for when I do live streaming and those kinds of things. But that's geeky extras.
But what are the two monitors you're using? And also tell us what the teleprompter is.
Okay, so the two monitors that I'm using as dual monitors are from LG. I don't know the model number, but I picked it up. It's a 24-inch diagonal LED screen. I got them at Costco for $125 or something like that. And they're fine for my purposes. I'm not doing a lot of technical photo editing and video stuff that color correction really matters. And so it's a nice balance of price and quality for nice big screens. The teleprompter is a gosh, I've had it for years. I don't remember the name of the maker, but there's a bunch of them. Originally, it was designed to work with an iPad as the screen, and it's just, okay, you know, cameras behind a mirror, and you see what's on the screen and read it. About a year ago, I bought a smaller little flat panel monitor that fits in the place of the iPad, so I'm not having to dedicate my iPad to that. And so it's always connected. But like I said, that's geeky stuff, tech stuff. It's fun.
But so does the teleprompter, does that have a cam in it?
No, the camera actually sits on a mount behind the mirror,
okay,
of the teleprompter. Okay. So what you have is a half-silvered mirror, so it passes light,
yep,
pretty well through. And the lens is right behind the center of the mirror, and the mirror is over the monitor that's laying flat, perpendicular, flat, parallel to my desk, basically. Cool. And so what scrolls by on the monitor scrolls by on the mirror, and it's reversed. This little monitor I have has a switch to create a mirror image, and it makes it very easy to put some text on the screen and read it if I want to, or have an outline, or just for these kind of calls to be able to look you right in the eye and communicate.
What kind of camera are you using, or webcam?
So I was using, up until very recently, I was using a Logitech Brio webcam. I think it's the 4K model. I don't even know.
And it is. The Brio is the 4K. Have it. We're talking on it right now.
Yeah. Super clear, bright picture, really good. Comes with some software. You can zoom in and out a little bit and those kinds of things. And I love it. But I wanted to throw the background behind me out of focus a little bit.
Okay.
And the Brio, because it's got such a small sensor and just the way the lenses and things work, it's not real good for that. And so be it. And again, being the geek that I am and having money, I guess, to spend on things, I went and bought a Canon M50 mirrorless digital SLR and a Sigma 16mm lens that has very wide aperture that lets you get that soft focus background. And it has great autofocus. So if I step away from my desk.
Right.
It keeps me in focus. And because I do some teaching and other things, it's just a useful setup.
Cool. I have some headphones on.
Yeah.
What brand is that?
Oh, let me think. I got to take them off and look. I think these are from Source Audio Status Audio, I think is the name of the company. I don't know the model number, but again, I'm not doing such mission critical stuff that I needed to invest a tremendous amount of money in them, but comfort on my head. If we're wearing headphones for hours and hours in a day, it gets to be uncomfortable. If they're not really well built. So these have a nice ear cushion and the sound quality is good. And being a sound guy, I do care about the sound quality, but I'm not investing $300-$500 in a pair of headphones.
Then we won't talk about the Apple AirPod Max that I'm wearing. Sorry, I couldn't remember the name.
Is that what those are?
Yeah, I got these when I was in Hawaii. I had planned, we had a trip to Hawaii and I was planning on getting a pair, and Apple's got this great 14-day return policy. I figured I'd take it on the trip and try them out. And I just ran out of time, and we get to Hawaii, and I had no plans on going to the Apple store there, although I would have loved to just to be a geek. But what happened was my wife and I were at the beach, and I'm in maybe 4 foot water, 5 foot water. I dropped my phone into the and I'm like, all right, great. So we get back to the hotel. I say, hey, do you have a bag of rice? So I want to dry it out, charge it up and go from there. And they did. And it was working, except that when I tried to plug it in, there's a little grain of salt. That got stuck in there. And so I had to take it over while they were playing with it. I was playing with these and I'm like, oh yeah, I got to get these. And when you try them on, they really are fantastic.
No, but they sound good. They feel comfortable. And you get the Bluetooth and the noise canceling. I do have noise canceling headphones that I spent a little more money on, but I don't use them for this kind of thing.
It's just less wires in my visual, which is what I prefer. But of course, if you look at my desk, you'll see a lot of wires. So tell us what else you got back there, because I see a light in the back that says that you're on air. I'm curious about that. I see all these different little products that come out saying, hey, you're on air or in a meeting.
Yeah. So in my background, I've got a handful of lighting, and actually my lights changed. So I'm going to turn the shelf lights back on. Okay. But that's really just about set decoration. The sign that you see that says live on air used to be on the outside of my office door to tell the kids, hey, shut up, I'm recording. I now have a different sign for that. So I thought, oh, it'd be cool to have that background there. And I've got a bookshelf with some LED strips behind it, and just to decorate. Nothing exceptional. Stuff I get on Amazon, stuff I find out there. And it really is purely aesthetic. And the other thing that you see behind me on the wall is the hexagonal panels. Those are 3/4-inch felt panels that help to deaden the sound in the room, because I am in what is essentially a 10 by 10 cube. That means lots of echo and stuff like that. Yeah. I've got a felt desk mat down under my keyboard, and I try to get nice and close on the microphone so you're not hearing any room echo, but that helps deaden things as well. And carpets and window blinds and all those kinds of things help.
Excellent. Is there any other piece of tech you'd like to share with us?
I'll tell you, the lights that I'm using on my video right now are Elgato key lights.
Okay.
And they mount to the desk and they're flat panel. I used to have these big soft boxes and whatnot all over here. And this just makes it much easier. I'm using a sit-stand desk from FlexiSpot. So I'm standing right now, but when I'm doing my law work, I'm sitting. And what else? No, it's actually...
You have a printer?
Yeah, I've used an old Brother laser something or other, just a wireless printer here for the house. And I do have a scanner also. I love my Fujitsu ScanSnap.
It's a lawyer's mainstay, especially if you're a solo or small practitioner. I've got one right over there. And the one thing we haven't mentioned, your phone.
I'm an iPhone guy.
Okay. And which iPhone do you have?
So I have the 13 Max or whatever it is.
Yeah. Pro Max.
Yeah, I think so. Mainly went to get that because my oldest son, who's 14, he needed a phone last Christmas. And so I thought, well, I'll give him the old one and get the new one for myself. And for me, it's a business tool. I also have an iPad. I have an iPad Pro that I use with the pen, and I take all my notes and things like that in there. So it's just right in the system automatically.
Now, do you have the M1 or the M2 chip?
I'm on the M1 chip.
Okay. Same here. They came out with the M2 chip, I believe, just recently.
Within the last 4 or 5 months, I think. Yeah. I hear great things about it, but I also don't think that I need the upgrade urgently.
Agreed. No, I agree. I absolutely, like, for instance, I have the Max with the M1 Ultra.
Oh, nice.
And even though they're supposed to be coming out with the M2 soon, I don't feel the need. And the specs that I'm seeing, I don't see the name that's comparable with you have with your iPads, any other device. I would pretty much just skip the M2 if you have an M1, unless you just really need the processing.
Well, but since we're talking about Max a little more, if you don't mind,
please,
I'll jump in.
Please.
Just a little tip I got. I just happened to be my MacBook Pro that I take with me when I go to teach my class and those kinds of things. It's a 2017 model 13-inch Mac Pro. And so it's still on the Intel chip, but the battery started giving me an error message saying, hey, service recommended or whatever. So I took it into the Apple store just last week. And unfortunately, it's not bad enough that they'll replace it for free.
Right.
So I'm going to wait it out. But while I was talking to the guy, I was looking and said, should I just buy a new MacBook Pro? He says, no. Get an Air. And we got into this whole conversation about it. And if you look at the specs of the MacBook Pro M1 and the equivalent chip in the Air, it's so close that I said, so what's the difference? He says, about $400. He could not point me to a technical difference between these two machines.
And that makes sense, except for me. I have a MacBook Pro 16-inch.
As you get into the larger screens and the more ports and things like that.
Right. But it's not an issue so much of ports. It's an issue of screen and real estate. When I'm mobile, I need that real estate usually, even though I can use my iPad as a second screen when I'm on the road.
Yeah, but, and I do that. I actually have a second flat screen that I can bring with me for if I need it. But most of the time when I'm teaching, I'm hooking up to the big screen in the classroom.
Wait, you're not using your iPad as a second screen?
Sometimes.
Okay. Or is it a third screen? You get the flat panel and...
Sometimes I do that. It really depends. Often what I do is I'll hook up the laptop to the big screen or the projector in the room, and I'll use the iPad as a remote for my keynote presentation.
Gotcha. Cool. And that's a good idea.
That way I can walk around the room and interact with the students a little more, and I think they probably hate it. But it
depends on how old the students are. Is it college or high school?
It's college undergrads, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not as bad as high school students. I think they would really hate it. But, college students, hopefully they're a little bit more mature. Can't guarantee that. But let's get into the questions.
Okay.
What are the top three reasons a lawyer would want to start a podcast?
I will say that I think that podcasting is easier than blogging in the sense that you can be conversational. You don't have every word that goes on the page, and it doesn't have to just be, we write in a sort of legalistic way. And I think that the voice that we capture of ourselves when we're recording is more congenial. So it's friendlier. It's just easier to connect with the audience. You still probably put an outline together and a lot of the same things you do with blogging. But then you can take the transcript and post it to a blog or excerpt and those kinds of things. Second reason I would say podcasting is great is it establishes you as the expert in the field that you're talking about. Even when you're interviewing a guest, their expertise rubs off on you, the interviewer. And so it's a great way to project a kind of credibility, develop a kind of credibility. Mm-hmm. And when you have that regular content coming out on your blog or on your website and on the podcast and maybe on YouTube and stuff, when people go Google your name, they're going to mm-hmm. find all that stuff and see that you're an expert on these kinds of things. The third thing, and this is one that I don't think a lot of people think about, is when you have a podcast and you interview guests who are in your sort of target client base community, you don't need a pretense for calling them and asking them to have a conversation that can then lead to that know and trust. That gets built automatically and organically when you allow them to talk about themselves and the things they care about, which after all is themselves. So people love to be asked questions about what they do. And
of course, Pardon the interruption. I hope you're enjoying this episode. Consider sharing this show with others. And please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your download feeds. If you're listening directly from our blog, consider buying us a cup of coffee or two from the link on our blog to help defray some of the production costs. Thanks again and enjoy. And I remember when I started off as a lawyer looking for my first job, I did a lot of information interviews because I'd say, I want to learn about what you do because it's what I want to do. And then, of course, they'll say, oh, yeah, I'm happy to talk about myself. And then hopefully that will lead maybe to some direction of trying to find the next job or a job.
Yeah. But so it's a networking kind of intro.
Yep.
Yeah. It's great.
And I wanted to backtrack a little bit, be anecdotal about your first two answers. Because when I started the blog, in a sense, I had no idea what I was doing and I knew what I wanted to do. But at the same time, I'm also working full time. And I found that getting as many entries on the blog was slower and harder the amount and quality I wanted to do. So at the same time, I heard about this thing called podcasting and I started doing that. And I agree with you, the podcasting is easier and it's a little bit more fun because you're not so scripted. You get to talk to interesting people. You get to share what you know. You get to hear about new things. I've learned something new today. I've learned new things in all the different podcasts I've done. I'm sure some of my listeners may be a little tired of listening to some of my same answers again. For instance, I know you're a Big Mac guy. And if I mentioned this to you at PodFest, forgive me for repeating this, but you should check out Mac Power Users podcast.
Oh, yeah.
David Spock.
Yeah, actually... David and I have talked and I've had him on a show I had a while back about podcasting lawyers.
Okay. And he quit being a lawyer. He's full steam on Max Sparky and his podcast.
Living the dream.
Exactly. I inspired to be him. But going back to your second answer, becoming the expert in the area, if I remember the exact answer you gave, I've been getting calls from journalists and they're asking me about this regarding technology and law and this and that, so to speak. And that's getting my name out in a different way. Granted, it's not the focus of my law practice, which is fine, which sort of goes in your third answer, because I'm not doing this to enhance the law practice. I'm doing this out of sense of fun and enjoyment. I get a lot of kicks out of just playing with technology and trying to figure out how to utilize it so that work in law can be easier. Let's move on to the second question. What are the top three legal issues lawyers should be concerned when doing a podcast? And we talked off mic about whether it be release forms, references to your site and services, UPL.
I think that the big issue that anybody who's podcasting needs to be sensitive to is intellectual property, because we all grew up with radio or other sources of music in our lives, and we want to have that vibe of a fully produced thing with music and all that. But the copyright law makes that, and frankly, just the right thing to do with respect to the owners of those copyrights, makes that very hard to do in the podcasting space. So we need to know and understand about how copyright law works when we quote from things, when we use other people's stuff, essentially. And so intellectual property legal issues can rear their ugly head pretty easily in the podcasting space. I don't know that UPL is a big concern, but I think that lawyer advertising can be. If you are using a podcast to promote your business, your practice, different states have different rules about what's okay and what's not. Now, I think that if you're doing a podcast, even if you're talking about your field of law, which may be interesting to some and boring to others, if you're giving generalized information, I don't see it as very different from what you would be doing if you wrote a book.
Okay.
If each episode is like a chapter of a book that you're talking about a particular area or some case studies or something like that, I don't think that crosses the line into commercial speech. until you go on and say, and if you have this problem, call me at 555, whatever. And so you just need to be conscious and aware of what the lawyer advertising rules in your community, if you're doing a substantive legal story, legal podcast.
So podcasting has no boundaries. It's the internet. It's worldwide.
Yeah.
So if I'm Joe Schmo talking about a personal injury case, and I could be your personal injury lawyer,
yeah,
and I live, work, and practice in state A, but state B next door says, hey, you're encroaching and advertising in our state, and you're not following our rules, we're going to discipline you, even though the lawyer in state A has no business mm-hmm. at the state.
Yeah,
should I think we be concerned about that? Because I've seen some states say, hey, you've been playing in our pond and we don't like it, even though you're not really playing in their pond.
I think that some of those issues have been settled with television advertising, where the TV signal from a station in Arkansas crosses into mm-hmm. Texas. Does Texas get to regulate that lawyer merely because that ad happens to bleed in? I don't think so. I think also here in the U.S., we're fortunate that we have a First Amendment, freedom of speech.
Right.
And if what we're creating is educational, informative, political, artistic kind of speech rather than mm-hmm. purely commercial, we have very strong protections. It's when it crosses into that commercial arena that the state has a little more interest in regulating. I'm not too concerned about that territorial boundaries issue as much as the state that has jurisdiction over you, certainly, Matt. And I think another big concern would frankly just be, and I think most of us are tuned in enough to know, we're not giving direct specific legal advice on our show.
Right.
We are not answering a question directly responsive to that question. On some of my live streams and things, I will take a question from the audience and generic it down.
Right.
I had a question about XYZ and how long copyrights last. And then I can answer the question without responding to their particular legal need.
So let's pause that for a second, because you touch on a follow-up question I had.
Yeah.
So someone from you're in state A, someone from mm-hmm. state B heard you about copyright law, thought, oh my God, this guy's fantastic. I've got to hire him. Okay? And you do all your retainer and your engagement letters, all state and based in state A.
Yeah.
But state B said, hey, hold on a second. You're advertising to residents in our state, so we don't like the way you're doing it. We're going to investigate you, sanction you. See what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I do. I think it calls to mind actually International Shoe to talk about jurisdictional questions. Do you really have minimum contacts with that other state merely by virtue of your podcast being listenable there? I don't think so. I haven't researched it specifically, but that's a real question. Now, if you take the client from that other, that's where you're violating law. That's where you're UPL, I think.
If you take them in, I was like,
if I'm located in California and someone from Nebraska hires me and I'm not licensed in Nebraska, unless there's a really solid nexus between the legal matter and the state that I'm in, I am practicing without a license in the other state.
But in my hypothetical, whatever the issue was that the person from state B hired you from deals in state A.
Oh, yeah. If you've been in an accident in California, come hire me. And then someone from Nevada comes and hires me. Yeah. But I probably wouldn't take out an ad in Nevada papers.
That makes sense. So what about release forms?
Michael, this is a crusade that I've been on. I think that everybody who interviews guests on their podcast would use some kind of a written or at least an online release form of some sort that captures the consent to the recording, whether you're in a one-party recording consent aid or two-party or whatever, capture that consent and also explain the scope of what's going to be done with this recording so there can be no misunderstandings when you later decide to use the transcript and turn it into a book or publish a greatest hits episode or something like that. Your guest shouldn't be in a position to come at you later and say, hey, not what we agreed, take it down. Now, that doesn't say if the guest has a good reason why it's going to hurt them, their job, they're going to lose their job or something, you certainly can. You have the flexibility, but that should be your decision, not the guest's decision. So consent and also ownership of copyright is an interesting area here. When two or more people get together to create something as a single unitary whole, like a podcast episode, under the law as it stands, without any specific intention otherwise, they're going to look like joint authors and therefore joint owners of the copyright with joint rights to exploit, but also it clouds the sort of chain of title. Now, that's not a big issue most of the time, but every once in a while, someone's going to take their show and go exclusive on Spotify, and then they need to be able to show they've got ownership of all those episodes.
Oh, okay.
So okay. If you're even thinking about positioning to make a sale or join a network or something like that, getting those ducks in a row is important. And we lawyers do as I say, don't do it, not as I do in this one, but we think we know, but it's always someone comes out of the woodwork when you least expect it. And if you have to take an episode down and you've got a sponsor on that episode, now you just breached your contract with your sponsor. So it can
How long does a sponsorship of a particular episode last?
I think that's a little like asking how long is a piece of string, right? How long is that episode going to live? I think, you know, it's a bigger issue, of course, if the takedown happens within 2 or 3 months after the episode than if it's 2 or 3 years later. But still, I think the implication, at least for host read ads and things like that, is that they stay with the episode for the life of the podcast.
Fair enough. I tell guests, as I've told you or will tell you, that once the episode's released, you're welcome to use it for your own PR media necessities.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. I've just never thought that someone would come back and say, oh, take that down. Obviously, if it was wrong or something came out bad, I would fix it or take it down, of course. But I guess, how do you approach someone who's doing, in a sense, to be blunt, you're doing me a favor of coming on, and I greatly appreciate it. But by the way, Gordon, I know you're helping me here and you're doing me a favor, but do you mind signing this?
It's a two-way street. Remember, I'm also getting access to your platform and your audience. So I wouldn't be doing it if there wasn't a little bit of self-interest involved. Maybe it's just like,
wait, you're self-interested here? Oh, no.
I just like the sound of my own voice and playing with my toys. But the way I do, and I don't have guests on my show very often, but the way I do it and the way I recommend others to do it is when they book the appointment on the scheduling calendar. I use Acuity scheduling. There's Calendly and there's a bunch of these others out there. I actually have the text of my release form on that questionnaire that they answer and a checkbox. Do you agree to the above terms and conditions? They click it and we're good to go. And the law is pretty clear that click wrap agreements like that are valid and enforceable. And if nothing else, it just puts them on notice that you're being serious about this thing. Would I want to necessarily send them a PDF and say, hey, print this, sign it, and fax it back to me or something crazy? It gets unwieldy. You could even do it orally if you have the script down and you can read it. You just want that manifestation of the intent to be bound by these terms. Right. And it can be done conversationally. And I think it does project a kind of professionalism.
So what would you advise other podcasters, and perhaps myself included, that, hey, we have so many episodes in the can, but we never got that release. Can we go back and somehow say, hey, do you mind releasing this?
That's a great question. I think I probably wouldn't. If it was myself, I don't think I would bother going back. I would just clean up my act going forward and hope for the best. Now, if I have a couple of episodes that are cornerstone content, I might, or if I go and I'm planning to repurpose that content for something, put it inside an online course or write a book or something, then I would go back. But no, once it's out there and you haven't had any problems, that's a sleeping dog you let lie.
Okay. This is all very good to know. And these are things that would be great to hear at a podcasting conference.
You think?
Yes. And unless I missed that particular session at the podcasting festival that you and I went to and met, I think that would be like, here is a session on all the stuff you need to be considering legally when doing a podcast. Now, if I've forgotten and you did it and I missed it, I apologize.
No, this year, my topic at PodFest was a little narrower. I covered one aspect of that and it does cover the release. But my topic was about why you need a podcast prenup. Right. I'm not talking about when you're working with co-producers, co-hosts, anybody else, including guests coming on your show. I'm talking about the pitfalls and the solutions to dealing with that.
But I do remember I did see it because you also at PodFest, which is the podcasting conference that you and I both met at last October?
No, just in January.
January. Okay. I'm going to a lot of conferences in the last year. At PodFest, you also had a link to a bunch of release forms.
Yeah.
If I recall correctly. And maybe it'd be nice enough to share that with our listeners for me to put in our show notes. But that I'll leave to you.
No, I'd be delighted. As I said, this is my crusade. I want people using this. I've provided a free podcast guest release form, free. You have to give me your email address, but then I'm going to send you this form. Go to podcastrelease.com, fill out the form, download the zip file, and open it up, and you've got the form in a couple of different formats.
I will be absolutely sure to put that in the show notes, and hopefully you'll get some more emails, including mine.
Yeah, okay.
So for our last question, What are your top three favorite pieces of technology, whether it's hardware or software, that you use to make your podcast recordings great? And I know we got number one as being the mic and the mixer.
Yeah, those are certainly on the top of my list. A Mac is a fantastic tool. It really, it does everything I need it to do and much, much more. And so I love my Mac Mini. You've got a Mac Studio. Same basic. I've got a little Envy now, but I'd say that's on my list. And then software. Interesting. That's a hard
one. Well, so I'm going to ask you to pause that for just a second. So let's go back to the Mac Mini for a second.
Sure.
So you have a mixer that does everything internally.
Yeah.
So what do you use the Mac Mini for then?
The Mac Mini is the hub of the communications with the outside world. Right now, I'm not going through that Rodecaster at all. You're getting it direct through the Mac, through the Zoom call. And when I do a call with my co-host, that's a Skype call. We're using Skype. We've been using it for 14 years and not going to change it if it works. We've been doing a Skype call. The Skype call comes out of the Mac into the Rodecaster and then records there. And the Mac is where I do what little editing I do and create the show notes and upload everything. And these days I'm doing a lot of video live streaming as well.
Okay.
I'll say, I think that's the answer to my third technology item is the software that I use for live streaming is called Ecamm Live. And it is a beautiful piece of software that allows me to create basically a television show or a live stream, multiple cameras, overlays, lower third things that slide in, video, play a video, presentations, whatever, right here on my Mac with just a few keystrokes. And boy, that technology is something else. When I was in school studying radio, TV, and film production, it was a whole room full of gear that you needed to do what you can now do from your desktop with a computer and a mouse.
Let's take that in a different direction for just a second. We talked about what you do for video. What do you think is the best piece of software to use for podcasting when the two people are not in the same room?
I think from a software point of view, it's a, I'm going to say Riverside.fm is the tool of choice for a lot of podcasters. That it's the connectivity between two people, records on both ends simultaneously. Mm-hmm. If you and I were talking over Riverside, I'd be making a recording, you'd be making a recording. When we're done, it's going to upload them, merge them, and give the host of the show both a merged mixed file as well as the individual audio files and the video. So you can cut audio and do your editing and mixing and all the after the fact if you want. But if you get a good quality recording, you're just done with it and output like you do with the Zoom.
So it seems like it has a lot of features to it.
Yeah.
But say compared to Zoom and Skype, why would I want that instead?
The sound quality from these tools, like Riverside is in a class of these tools. There's a couple of others out there that do the same thing. Riverside's the top of mind for me these days. I think the quality of the sound is far superior to what you get on a Zoom call or a Skype call, certainly without any extra tinkering. So I did a lot of tinkering with the Skype call, so I'm feeling pretty good about that and not going to make any drastic changes. But that's one. And it's much easier for the guest not to have to download additional software, not to have to tinker with things and on their end to get this to happen. You just load up a link in a browser and you're off to the races.
And you're talking about Riverside FM.
Riverside, yeah. It's
okay.
You sign up, you get an account, you send the guest a link, and bang, they show up in your little studio on Riverside and you're good to go.
So basically what I'm hearing is that with Riverside A versus Zoom and Skype is that you get a better sound quality. You have a lot of options when it comes to your video. And also you get individual recordings in addition to a combined recording with Riverside versus the Zoom, which with Zoom, either I can keep the entire file, the recording, or I can keep it uploaded on the cloud. And I'm not sure how Skype works. I'm assuming this allows you to download or record.
Yeah, Skype doesn't actually do any recording. That's something that's happening on my end when we do.
Oh, okay. So then it seems like then it would be, can't you use Skype then for podcast recording, but you could use Zoom for podcast recording. I'm sorry, can't use Skype without some sort of additional hardware.
Yeah, or software. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I got it. So Skype is out for the newbie, but Zoom would be okay. And then if you want to graduate, perhaps Riverside FM. I greatly appreciate your thoughts. And more importantly, I appreciate you being on here today. Please tell us where people can find you.
Michael, it's been a real pleasure. Best way to find me is my name, GordonFiremark.com. We'll get you to the website that has all of my sort of courses and information products. And Firemark.com is the law practice blog / podcast.
Right.
And the name of my main podcast is called Entertainment Law Update. And you can find that on most podcast platforms.
And I will be sure to have all of that in the show notes. And again, I want to thank you for being on.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for joining me on this episode of the TechSavvyLawyer.page podcast. Our next episode will be posted in about 2 weeks. If you have any ideas about a future episode, please contact me at MichaelDJ@TechSavvyLawyer.page. Have a great day and happy lawyering.
Of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.